I'm Maya Garantz.
And I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
We have a lot of things we're going to ruin this episode, in part because there's just so much going on that is relevant to our interests and also stuff we've talked about previously, and we can't let another week go by without addressing some of the stuff that's been in the news.
Right. This is going to be kind of a catch-up week for a lot of things that we have to get to. So we're just going to get to a lot of stuff.
Yep. So let's get to it. Okay, Maya, I have an idea.
Yes.
I think we should post pictures of our cocktails on Instagram.
Oh, that's very nice. That's a lovely idea.
We could even try to make cocktails. This is my ideal world scenario, but we could make cocktails that are themed to sort of match the topic of the show. And then we could have Instagram pics, and maybe in the text you give a little ingredient list or recipe for the cocktail.
Okay, here's the thing.
What?
The thing is that that can only work if we're getting like paid by liquor companies. I feel like when are we going to get paid by these alcohol conglomerates to do what we do?
Are you listening, alcohol conglomerates? Because we are keeping you in business.
That's right. That is right.
Show a little love in return. All right. Well, we don't have such sponsorship yet. But in the meantime, what are you drinking right now?
I'm like deep in the whiskey sour land, homegrown lemons, homemade simple syrup.
Oh, wow.
Some very, very fancy whiskey that somebody gave us, so I don't feel bad about using it for mixed drinks. And the thing is that I'm super pre-gamed.
Yeah.
So we're going to get drunker than we usually get. And it's going to be something tonight. And actually, I was pre-gaming with an old grad school friend of mine, Michael Jaros, who's like a professor of English. Mm-hmm. And he listens to us when he goes jogging.
How nice.
He says he listens to us and the Savage Love podcast, and we are what keeps him going through the jogging. I felt very flattered by that.
That's flattering company to be in. And yeah, you have to hold someone's interest when they're jogging. I'll tell you that.
Absolutely. And he asked me, he was like, oh, you're recording tonight? You have to give me a shout out. And so I'm like, I'm going to give you a shout out because I pre-gamed with you. So thank you, Michael Jaros.
Thank you, Michael, for listening and for helping get Maya pretty well sauced before we even started. I am drinking scotch, just Ardbeg 10, because our guest from last week, Alex, drank us out of scotch here in the household. So I went and bought a nice new bottle.
Very good.
I'm very happy with it.
I have one more piece of listener feedback, by the by.
Okay.
We got an email saying, hi, Sauce. I'm your audience from Taiwan. And he says, I love the sauce. It gives me new perspective on American culture and society and helps me look at things from a different angle. I appreciate the inspiring messages of each and every episode. Can't wait to see what's coming. Please excuse any mistakes as English is my second language. Best regards, Johan. So Johan from Taiwan.
Wow.
Thank you so much.
International audience.
Love it.
I feel really big time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love our international audience.
If anyone else is listening internationally, we would love to hear from you. I want to know what our reach is. Tell us what country you're listening in.
Also, I'm really interested to see that among people who show up on our website, we have people from like Norway and Canada and Denmark and the UK, and we've had listeners from Belgium, but we also have listeners from what WordPress tells me is the European Union.
Oh.
And I'm like, why is
How
that
vague.
Not nation specific?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, that is correct. So I'm like, what is going on? European Union. Yeah.
Mysterious. I have one other bit of listener feedback to share.
Yes.
I was talking to Guy Branum, our friend and friend of the pod. He was a guest on an episode some time ago. And he told me he was listening to our episode about Great British Baking Show, aka Great British Bake Off, and was somewhat surprised to find that we didn't make reference to the article he wrote about Great British Bake Off the week before. He literally wrote a think piece about it the week before. It appeared on a website called publicbooks.org. Okay. And it's a great piece. I highly recommend you look it up. It's called Bake Britannia. Listeners, if you enjoyed our episode on that topic at all, you'll definitely enjoy Guy's take. He had a lot of similar things to say to what we said, which he said frustrated him a little because he thought his ideas maybe weren't as insightful as he had thought. And I was like, excuse me, we are also insightful.
I think he's just jealous. I think he just wants to be with us every week. Guy, do you want to be back with us every week? Because I understand that. Come on. Come on over.
Guy, yeah, I'm sure that anytime anyone's sharing opinions, Guy wants to be part of it. But it's actually a lovely piece. And he sort of was saying what we were saying about this redefining of Britishness. And he kind of takes it a step further and points out that while the judges are really open to new flavors from contestants who are coming from different parts of the world, they're strangely closed off to new flavors that are coming from parts of the world that weren't colonized by Britain.
Oh!
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, he gives a few examples, and I thought that was very well noticed. And he has a few other nice insights and then says a lot of the things we said, but more articulately. So thank you, Guy. I'm sorry I didn't see your piece before our episode. We would have mentioned it.
Of course we would have. All right, my friends. We just have to take a couple of minutes on this amazing... We've been wanting to talk about this for a couple of weeks, but we haven't had time because we've been getting so deep with our amazing guests. I think we've had such incredible guests, we haven't had a chance to catch up on our own stuff.
Exactly.
There is an unbelievable article in the Washington Post. We will post the link. It's from a couple of weeks back, about how a black man outsmarted a neo-Nazi group and became their new leader. So... okay. This is an amazing story that I feel like is so much better than Black Klansmen. It's basically about this man named James Stern, who, while he was in prison, befriended Edgar Ray Killen, who had been convicted of the killings of Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney in 1964. And somehow by having these conversations about race with, like, really one of the most famous racists of the 60s, this guy, James Stern, got Killen to grant him power of attorney over his life story and his estate.
Wow.
Right? Okay, so that's how the story starts.
That's fucking wild. Okay.
Then... James Stern, this like black guy, starts having conversations with this guy, Jeff Shope, who led it's like the American Nazi Party. Okay.
Oh, okay.
You know, like those Nazis. And they became friends, and Shope started coming to him for legal advice. And before you know it, this new Nationalist Socialist Party was becoming financially a problem for the white supremacist. And so he handed it off to this black man who had been sort of having conversations with him. And now James Stern is in charge of this movement, of the National Socialist Movement. It's amazing.
That's incredible.
It's amazing. It's an amazing story. And I think it's really worth reading because it's all about this way that if you just sit there and have the conversation with a crazy person, you can end up legally in charge of the Nationalist Socialist Movement and then turn this Nazi, neo-Nazi party into a way of talking about race relations in the United States.
That's fucking amazing.
It's amazing.
All right, I have to read it. I didn't read it yet, but now I'm really intrigued.
Good. And it's the opposite of the white savior narratives that we were talking about. It's like a black savior narrative, mm-hmm. where just by having the conversation, this black man, who, by the way, was in jail for being a con man earlier in his life. It's not like he's some ideal victim or whatever. Like, he's somebody who sort of is a little bit of a con man. But by having the conversation, he was able to get his hands on the ownership of this insane organization and then be in charge of it and change what it means. And it's brilliant. It's brilliant. It is the Black Savior narrative.
It's really interesting to me that he was a con man, because mm-hmm. I'm sure that whatever skill he had as a con man was what he used to ingratiate himself with these white supremacists. And that also reminds me of the episode we did about Fyre Festival, and we talked about con men and the whole idea of the con.
Yes! Yes! But he was, when he met Edgar Ray Killen, who had been a KKK Grand Wizard, mm-hmm. he was serving time in prison for wire fraud in Mississippi. And, like, I have to read this line. Though Stern said Killen regularly called him a racial slur, he nevertheless granted his cellmate power of attorney over his life story and estate.
Gosh, there's so many layers to this story. There's so much going on.
There's so much going on in this story.
Post the link. You'll post the link on our Twitter on the Sauce.
I will.
At Sauce Podcast on Twitter. And then everyone can read it and tell us your thoughts about that, because that sounds really fascinating. All right. We're going to dive into several topics that have caught our attention over the past week or two that we just really can't avoid. And we know that you've all been talking and thinking about too.
And you've been waiting for us to talk and think about it. You've been like living your lives being like, when is the Sauce going to talk about this? We know, we're here for you.
You joke, you're being a bit facetious, but people do tweet at the Sauce and they ask us like, are you going to talk about this? So I think we should start with the big thing, which is the Mueller report. It's in. I was at a bar with friends Friday evening, 5 p.m., and I glance at Twitter, and I was like, Mueller just submitted his report. And everyone's like, oh, wow, okay, and went back to what they were doing. And I feel like the whole country did that. So my first question is, what would have ever caused him to submit this report at 5 p.m. on a Friday? That seems very calculated. Right. And I don't think Mueller's the one who calculated it that way.
Right.
Not to sound paranoid, but it's clearly obvious that Attorney General Barr and Trump via Barr are trying to control the narrative. They're trying to get ahead of the Mueller report and shape the conversation around it before it becomes public.
Okay, here's something that I want to talk about in terms of Barr's four-letter summary of the Mueller report.
You mean four-page summary?
Four-page summary. Okay, here's the thing, guys. This is what, again, I'm bringing up this podcast. It's like the 17th time I brought it up. There is this podcast. It's called Slow Burn. It's on Slate. It's about the Nixon. It's about Watergate. Okay. They reiterate over and over and over again that the only reason that Nixon was gotten mm-hmm. by what he did on Watergate is because it was being jumped on from so many different angles. There was a special prosecutor. There was what the Senate was doing. There was what the House was doing. It took years longer than even Mueller has taken. Nixon got reelected in the time that they were already doing this investigation. There was a Senate investigation that got shut down by Nixon's people kind of manipulating it. Like, the only reason that things happened the way they did for Nixon is because it was coming from so many different angles.
Yeah.
The fact that Barr, in his four-page summary, had to say that Trump was not exonerated.
Yeah.
I feel like this is like the episode that we did after the 2018 election, where we had to explain to people why they should not despair that the 2018 midterms were a big fucking deal.
And it was
I want to talk about how a big fucking deal it is that William Barr, who is a Trump appointee, had to say in his very brief summary that Trump was not exonerated. He had to explicitly say that.
And to put it into context, Barr, probably the whole reason he was selected for this role is that prior to being nominated, he spoke out against the Mueller investigation.
That's right.
He was, and not only that, he's also said he doesn't believe that the president can obstruct justice. It's kind of like a husband can't rape his wife kind of logic. He's the president, therefore he can't obstruct justice because he is the arbiter of justice or something like that. But this is the person who said that. And yes, included in his summary that the Mueller report neither proves nor exonerates the obstruction charge. So yeah, that is huge.
And we have Maxine Waters, the head of the finance, like, she has just subpoenaed some Deutsche Bank records, bitch.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
There is a lot going on. And between, like, there is no
There's still the Southern District of New York. There's still the New York AG, I think, is investigating some Trump stuff.
And it's not just that. It's the fact that, like, between all of the Democrats now in the House who are going to subpoena this report, the likelihood of this report being leaked, there is no way that we are not going to find out what is in this report. There is no fucking way.
Here's the thing, though. We're going to find out, and it's going to be the type of material that would easily have brought down any previous politician at any level, much less a president. But because it's not going to be the P tape.
Right.
The administration will call it a nothing burger. That's what they're
doing right
now. Like, this whole exercise they're doing now is not about keeping the report under wraps so no one ever sees it. It's about setting it up so that when it does come to light and, you know, they do their redactions and whatever so that the really juicy stuff doesn't get seen, and the stuff that does get seen is problematic. But it's not going to be enough. It's not going to be this sort of like smoking gun, salacious evidence. It's not going to be any of that stuff.
Right.
And the American public's attention for the details of different kinds of election fraud aren't, it's not really huge. So
here's the thing, though. The American public didn't give a shit about Watergate either.
Right,
and so again,
right.
I feel like we need to put this into context. Mueller did his work more thoroughly and more quickly than Watergate was investigated by the special prosecutor.
Yeah.
We have a house. Our job right now is to work on 2020. Our job right now is to write our representatives requesting the release of the Mueller report. We have a job to do right now. And the one thing we cannot do right now is despair. I honestly feel like the fact that William Barr had to be like, this doesn't exonerate him, to me says, like, it is so fucking dirty and bad.
Yeah.
There is no way out of this.
That's, I know. And I'm trying to hold on to that. My worry is that the, you know, the House is about to subpoena the report, and I'm worried that they're not going to hand over the report and it's going to create like a constitutional crisis. And I don't have a lot of faith in our highest courts to not side the president on that. So, you know, that's a worst case scenario, but it's also a very realistic possible scenario.
Well, we're going to stay on it. But I feel like, again, I was thinking about the ways that when we were talking about the Mueller investigation is a procedural, how the procedural isn't a whodunit. It's a how was it done? Because we know who did it.
God, that's like, so true.
There was that Atlantic article. It was like, we don't even need the Mueller report. This is what we have publicly confirmed. And it proves that they done it.
Right, right.
As long as we keep our eye on what is actually there, I think that it's going to be okay. I believe in it.
All right. I appreciate that level of optimism. I would also note we've often compared this investigation to The Wire as an example of a very fine procedural. And you might also note what happens in the last episode of every season of The Wire. Spoiler alert, folks, if you haven't watched The Wire.
Then, you know what? If you haven't watched The Wire, I have no sympathy for your spoiler alerts. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
I know. Like, what's the statute of limitations on that shit? Because, yeah, you should have watched it by now. But, you know, the last episode of each season the second to last episode is where they bring everything to a head and they get that evidence and they finally like unlock that final piece of evidence that's going to put it all together. And the last episode is where the powers that be go, no, hush, hush, shove that under the rug.
That's right.
This guy's connected to somebody. You're not going to go anywhere with this.
That's right.
Yeah.
But I think that there are enough people out there who are watching and waiting. I do. I really do.
I hope you're right.
All right, guys, I think we're going to have to talk about Joe Biden, the pervy hair sniffer.
I mean, we all knew he was a hair sniffer, right?
Oh, my God. Like, his whole thing, he's like one of those guys who, like, hugs a little too long. We all know that he says that. He's like, I'm a hugger.
And I'm very tactile, he said, which is a really gross way of putting it, too. It's just like, wow, not only is the action creepy, but the way you're phrasing it is making it worse.
I'm very tactile.
What we're referring to is a piece that appeared in The Cut by Lucy Flores, a politician from Nevada. And she tells very bluntly and frankly the story of when she was running for lieutenant governor in Nevada and Joe Biden came to help her and other candidates boost turnout. And he unexpectedly approached her from behind, put his hands on her shoulders, sniffed her hair, and kissed the back of her head. Maya is making the most grossed out face right now. It's so skeevy. It is, like you said, we all know that guy, right? Every family has that uncle or like, you know, when you were in high school, there was always the friend whose dad was kind of like that. Like he'd give you a shoulder massage when you weren't asking for one. And you were like,
It sort of reminds me of this, like Nick Kroll and John Mulaney were the hosts for the Independent Spirit Awards a couple of years back. It was really good.
I bet.
And they were completely went so honest about Me Too. It was really good. And they're like, what's wrong with a hug? And it's like, not the way that you're doing it, buddy. Like all kind of low and breathy. Yeah. It's true.
It's true. And she addresses a lot of it in the piece because she recognizes that what she's describing is not illegal activity. It doesn't meet most people's definition of assault or sexual
assault. That's right.
It's just weirdly inappropriate. And I love the way she very frankly describes how it made her feel, which
yes.
I think most women can relate to, or most femmes, most people who present as femme could probably relate to. She says, my brain couldn't process what was happening. I was embarrassed. I was shocked. I was confused. There is a Spanish saying, trágame tierra. It means earth, swallow me whole. That really struck me. Like, oh, don't you know that feeling when you just wish you could get swallowed up by the earth? You're like, I don't want to be in this situation right now. This is not good. Yeah. And I thought that Biden's official response, the thing I was worried he would do and he did not do is cite his good work in being a good ally to anti-sexual violence organizations. I was worried 100%. That it was going to be like, Joe Biden would never do this. He supports women in their anti-sexual violence movement. Like he didn't pull that up, which was a relief. But it also, speaking of his support for movements against sexual violence, it's very strange and puts everyone in a really awkward position. Because he has been good on that issue. But then again, we all know he's a hair sniffer. Like, we all knew this about him.
Okay, but here's the thing. We're in this place where they're the big monsters that we're acknowledging, that we're, like, seeing. We're calling them out. We're
Harvey
acknowledging
Weinstein,
the big monsters.
Yeah.
Harvey Weinstein, like, the big fucking monsters. Now, there's this more complex space, because I feel like also, to be very frank, there is a way that in the social space, there are the hair sniffers and we don't mind it. Or there are the people where you're like, this is weirdly erotic space or a place of this kind of flirtation.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's okay, right? sometimes it's not okay. No, I think sometimes, but this is what I'm saying. Like, we're getting to the place where it's not as easy as
to draw these bright lines.
This guy's a monster. This is a bright line. We're getting to this place where sometimes we work with people and we have this moment where we see this person and they see you and there's a slight erotic charge. And that's okay. Now, it wasn't okay for this woman with Joe Biden. And I think that I'm sure that there's this way that he feels like everything's okay at this point. He's not doing anything bad. He exists in this erotic space. Like,
I have no doubt that for Joe Biden, he does not think he's doing anything inappropriate.
Absolutely.
But I would quibble with the idea that he thinks it's an erotic space. I don't think he thinks there's anything erotic about it, at least not consciously.
Right.
And I think there's an important distinction there because there's a difference between flirting that is a result of that kind of, you know, sexual charge, mutual attraction. That's different from this situation. I don't think he thinks he was flirting. I don't think he was trying to be flirtatious. I think he was trying to be warm and supportive. And just his instinct for dealing with women who are younger than him is to be physical with them in that way. And I don't think he means it from a sexual perspective, but women feel it in that way.
Well, women, she describes feeling it as being very reducing of her.
Yes.
And I 100% understand that.
Oh, yeah.
I have 100% experienced that, where that kind of affection is saying, you are always this little girl. Your power is always going to be minimized in this way. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to support you, and through me as this gatekeeper, I'm going to say I support you, but you're never going to be really powerful. You're never going to be truly powerful.
That's so accurate. I was thinking about the men in my life who've behaved that way, and it occurred to me that they're always older men. And I don't mean older as in their old age, just older than I was at the time.
Right. Right.
So that seems very relevant to me. They are choosing younger women to do this to because, and I don't think there's like a conscious thing where they're like, I'm going to target this woman. She's nothing. She can't ever be powerful. But it's instinctual. They look at a younger woman and she seems like a little girl to them. All younger women are little girls. It reminds me of like my uncle. I remember being 10 or 11 and we were going out to some event and I got all dressed nice and my uncle comes in and he's like, oh, you're so adorable. And he hugs me and nothing inappropriate or weird, but just he was treating me like I was 5 or 6 when I was 10 or 11. And I remember it because my aunt was like, she looks like a young lady. Like he was like, oh, you look so cute. And she's like, she looks like a young lady. My aunt was trying to say, treat her more grown up.
Right.
And I noticed it at the time. In that moment, I was like, oh, she gets it. Like she gets it. I'm not the baby he wants me to continue to be. And there's an extent to which for some men, it's always like that. There's always this level of condescension. Younger women are girls.
Yeah. You know what? I'm sorry. I'm going to have to finally tell this story and I'm going to tell it online. Finally. Okay. Okay.
Fine.
So when I was applying for this job, the chair of the department was this guy. I'm going to fucking name him. Fuck it. I'm going to say it.
Are you sure?
I'm super ready to do this.
Because you've had a few drinks.
I have had a few drinks, but fuck it.
Okay.
And when you have an academic job interview, you go to dinner with the faculty of this department.
Oh, boy.
So we go to dinner, and I had read somewhere, like, don't have more than one drink, don't order dessert.
These
people are tired, like, just make it efficient. Make this dinner efficient. And I was super ready to do that. But he kept ordering the beers, and it was like a three-hour-long dinner. And he kept bringing up Me Too.
Oh,
and he kept saying to me, he kept bringing it up. And he's like, don't you think it's gone too far? Don't you think it's a witch hunt?
Oh, shit.
Don't you think it's...
What did you say to that? How do you respond?
This is a job interview.
I know.
This is a job interview. I can't say to him what I really want to say, which
right.
is you are clearly feeling guilty about how you've treated younger women in your sexual life, about the women who you've had sex with, who are younger women, mm-hmm. who you connected with because of your power as an academic, as this intellectual figure. Me Too is making him look at his own sexual life with inappropriately younger women, and uh-huh. he's feeling guilty. So he keeps bringing up to me, isn't it too far? Hasn't Me Too gone too far? Isn't the Al Franken thing too far? Isn't it a witch hunt?
So what I want to know what you said. How did you handle that?
So because it's a job interview, I can't say to him what I want to say, which is, it's clear that you are feeling maybe a little guilty about how you've treated younger women and their intellectual capacity and power so that you can fuck them using your like power.
Right.
And I had to be like, it's complicated, but it's not a witch hunt, because a witch hunt is when the men who are in power are against the witches. Like, a witch hunt is never the witches in power.
Right, right.
And it was this way that as a feminist, he wanted me to absolve him.
Yeah, yeah.
And this happened in another job interview that I had for another tenure track position where somebody was like, is FKA Twigs feminist?
Oh my God.
And he kept asking. He emailed me multiple times and he wanted me to say, yes, she's feminist, but she's not. She's awesome. She's hot. She's fantastic. But there's nothing that she's doing that's challenging things in this feminist way. There isn't. And if he keeps asking me, I'm going to tell you what I think. She's awesome. She's not challenging notions of beauty or power. Like, she's not.
Yeah.
And there was this way where these men in positions of power, maybe they didn't even know they were doing it, but they were asking me to absolve them
100%
of their behavior. And I could not do that for them. And I did not get either of those jobs. So I'm just saying.
That sucks.
But it's interesting that they kept bringing it up, because what they wanted me to say is, you're fine.
That's clearly on their minds. It's clearly weighing on them. And they want confirmation that they're okay.
That's right. And they're not okay.
And they're not okay.
And if I saw him right now, I'd say, you know what I didn't get to say because it was a job interview and I couldn't say this to you at a job interview, is that it's not okay. And you've done things that are not okay. And you have to contend with that and deal with that. And you have to face that. And that when I see the Joe Biden like sniffing my hair and being touchy and tactile and whatever and saying, hey, this is the way I am. Like, I feel that. I feel that so hard, because I know that at the same time that he makes the Violence Against Women Act important, there are ways in which he's behaving in the world that he doesn't want to take responsibility for.
Absolutely.
So this is our like miscellany catch you up episode. And I really wanted to share with you this amazing book called Say Nothing: A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland by Patrick Radden Keefe. It is about the troubles of Northern Ireland and the IRA. And it's so fucking good. Oh, shit. It is so good. And I think it's actually so important to read in this moment of political anxiety that we're living in, mm-hmm. because we see the ways that the Irish resistors and the IRA was fighting against this kind of political system, and the sort of decisions that they made, the brutal decisions that they made. It is an unbelievable book. I like inhaled it in a weekend. It is so good, guys, everybody. And I would say to all my listeners, so LA Public Library now has this thing, listen, where I can get any Kindle books I want through the LA Public Library.
Yeah.
And they just shoot it to my Kindle. And then when it's done, I don't have to pay any fees for returning it late. They just shoot it back.
Yeah.
It's really good. And sometimes I'll say to them, hey, you don't have this book. Get me this book. And they're like, okay. And then when they get that book, they'll say, hey, we got that book. And they'll just send it to my e-reader.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. That's, guys.
That's what libraries do now. It's amazing.
Libraries are so good.
Oh my God. I fucking love libraries. They're the best.
They're so good.
Don't forget they're there, people. Because you're like, oh, I want to read that book, but it's $50. You don't have to pay for books. You don't have to.
You don't even have to pay $10. They will shoot it to your e-reader. And then when it's done, they'll shoot it back and you don't have to pay any light fees. My friends, say nothing about the troubles in Northern Ireland. They will send it to your e-reader. Read it. It's so good. And then email us and we will do a whole episode about it.
Also, if you're not into e-readers because you have a thing about physical books, the library, you can go online and reserve a book and they will email you when it's ready. And then all you do is you show up and there's a shelf and it's alphabetized by last name. You find your book and you check it out. It's beautiful.
Libraries are so good.
I fucking love libraries. They're amazing. Okay. I have one thing I want to talk about.
Yes.
That we didn't actually plan on, but I had forgotten about it. I've been watching the second season of Queer Eye.
Oh.
Did you have you watched it?
Not yet. I started trying to, and it was kind of unbearable, and I couldn't do it.
I kind of love it. I'm super into it because it's Queer Eye. And I just am really into this idea that, you know, you're having trouble with your self-esteem and your confidence. Your life feels stalled. You don't know how to move out of this space you're in. What you need is a trip to West Elm and to learn how to do a French tuck, and everything's gonna be great and you're just gonna move forward as a human being. I love it. Okay, so I used Queer Eye as the contrast to Great British Baking Extravaganza in terms of how the Great British Baking Show teaches you inclusivity without explicitly teaching you. They never talk right. about it overtly. Right. But British people don't talk about shit overtly.
They model it for you. Right, right.
Whereas Queer Eye is all about just like, we're going to talk about it. We're going to pull it out there and we're going to talk about it. And I had this really interesting thought where they were making over a woman who's a hunter and outdoorsy lady, and she only wears camo and doesn't consider herself girly, but she kind of wants to be more happy with how she looks. And I want to say it was Bobby was talking to her about hunting, and I was like, oh shit, I had this show all wrong. I thought it was trying to teach middle Americans about gay people and trans people and people of color. But it's not. It's trying to teach elitist West and East Coast liberals about hunters.
Right.
Like, I wish they would right. do more of that, though, because they don't do that in every episode. But I was like, oh, shit, I've totally been duped. This show is teaching me to have sympathy for those people.
Right. Right.
But it'll never work.
Wow. You see, because that's the reason that I haven't been able to watch the third season, that I feel like, oh, like I don't buy it.
I know.
I'm just not buying
it. There's a certain level of artifice there always. And
even though Jonathan Van Ness, honestly, I'm so counting the minutes till the last season of Game of Thrones, just so I can watch the last season of Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones, yeah.
It's everything.
He's wonderful. They're all wonderful. And I am over the fact that Bobby makes everyone's apartment or house blue. I'm over it. It's fine. I like blue too. It's fine.
All right. Well, I have something else to bring up.
Okay.
So, Kieran Scarlett, I really want you to come on our podcast. Oh, I want you to come on our podcast so bad. He brought up in one of his tweets, he was like, why don't we talk about how hot Keegan-Michael Key is? Why don't we talk about what a beautiful man he is? And I just wanted to briefly mention, he is a beautiful man. And that show, Friends from College, which is a problematic show, but it's also targeted to exactly my generation, which is part of why it's problematic. Keegan Key gets to be the like romantic lead. And he's so beautiful. He is.
He is. He's a very attractive human. What I feel like is happening, though, is that he came to recognition via a comedy sketch show.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this unspoken rule that comedians are not allowed to be attractive.
That's right.
Oh, I mean, unless they're women, in which case they have to be attractive, but they can't be too attractive because then they're not funny
right,
and so forth.
Right, right. Yeah.
But there is this weird way in which if you're funny, like, you can be pleasing to look at. Like, you don't have to be offensive to the eye, but you're never going to have sex appeal.
And the thing is, he has immense sex appeal, and he's also, like, a great actor.
Mm.
Like, he's a really good actor. He can do, like, these sort of dramatic scenes or these scenes where it's, like, a lot of emotional nuance to them. It's not just right. This broad comedy. He's very, very good at that.
Aww.
And Friends from College is a really interesting show because it's about our generation of people. Like,
yeah.
And it's kind of embarrassing in that way. Like, it's a problematic show, but
is it? I've never watched it. What's problematic about it?
What's problematic about it is that it's setting up the situation of people who are in relation to one another. And it's trying to make it as bad as it can be. Like, there's no resolution. Like, it's very cynical in what it sets up about these people.
Okay.
And their ability to, like, manage with each other.
Yeah.
And it puts them in as poor of a situation or as difficult as a place as it can be. And it's sort of trying to humiliate their own characters.
Okay.
In as extreme of way as they can. And I feel like,
okay.
That's not what it really is. Like, what it really is that space in between the humiliation of it, but they're trying to, like, go to the extreme version of it.
Okay. So, when you say problematic, I thought you meant problematic in terms of, like, race, gender, class, or disability or some shit like that. But you just mean, narratively, it's challenging.
Yes. And what it's trying to do is get you as bought into it as you can to humiliate you or embarrass you.
Right.
It's not dealing with race at all. It's dealing with class 100% and it's dealing with gender. I think it's this post-racial fantasy where race is not actually managed at all, but class and gender are in this very explicit way.
Mm-hmm.
But what it's trying to do is like, just degrade the characters as much as humanly possible.
To what end? Like, why? Why do that?
I think to say that, like, look at... I think that transparent is very similar. It's, like, humiliating the humanity of people with privilege.
Mm.
Which I have no... I mean, humiliate privilege, sure. But using the things that are the most tender and intimate about them to do that, like the things that make them the most human, it feels like punching down instead of punching up.
Oh, now I'm intrigued and want to watch the show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. That was a good sell. Okay. With what time we have left, we've got to talk about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yes, we do.
Because this girl is a fucking phenomenon. And yes, I called her a girl. I know she is a grown-ass woman, but she's like, what is she, 28, 29? I'm sorry. To me, this is
girl. Child.
She's a girl child. She's an infant. Look, I really appreciate her for who she is and what she does. But
yes.
Also, there's this phenomenon on the right where they are obsessed with her.
They don't know what to do. They cannot manage it. They are out of control about her.
Right. Is it that they don't know what to do, Or is it that they know exactly what to do because she's the perfect boogeyman for them? She is the figure that they can hold up to convince the faithful that the left has lost its mind.
Here's the thing. I think part of what they don't know what to do with is that she's so charismatic. She's so attractive. Mm-hmm. Like, she's you know what's interesting to think about a comparison is the way the right wing is super pro Tulsi Gabbard, who is just so awful, and super anti-AOC. It's like these gorgeous brown women.
Yeah.
And part of why they love Tulsi Gabbard is because she's like the perfect person for them to objectify.
Oh, yeah.
And they want to objectify AOC and they cannot.
I think they absolutely do objectify AOC. Like, you saw it in that political cartoon we talked about, the late term abortion cocktail one.
Yeah.
I think that's part of their obsession with her, is that she is attractive, that she's young and attractive. And I think that objectification can take different forms. And one form that it takes is creating this like fantasy of this perfect woman because she has politics you agree with and she likes the geek shit you like or whatever it might be.
Right.
But it's still objectification.
Yes.
Because you're not interested in her as a fully dimensional human being. You're interested in her for what she can be and do for you.
Yeah, that's right.
And then there's another form of objectification where you just can't believe that a person who's attractive has a brain and is capable of complex thought.
Yep.
And you immediately dismiss anything she does or says as completely stupid because it came from a mouth that wears hot red lipstick beautifully.
Right.
She rocks a red lipstick like you can't do. Like, who can do that? She can. I'm fascinated by the right's fascination with her, in part because of that, in part because there's this obvious like unease and confusion about what to do with this attractive young ethnic woman.
Yes.
Who also could be a political force.
Also because she keeps killing it. She's so sort of shameless. She's not trying to sort of win in this political way. She's politically safe in terms of her own district. So she's able to call people out immediately, shamelessly, honestly. Like, this is what it is. And it's such a relief.
It's beautiful and it's refreshing. But she also plays the game where she needs to a lot of the time and doesn't call people out just for the sake of being that bitch who calls people out. So that she has earned at best skepticism from the sort of like Bernie faithful far left. You have people like Michael Tracy on Twitter saying, oh, she's just supporting the establishment. Because she does support the establishment where she thinks it could be advantageous to her and the party and the movement. And that endears her to me, you know, far more than anything. It's this like, yeah, I have an agenda. I have a far left agenda. But also I recognize that the way to get anything done involves me not being this like crazy ass purist who goes against the establishment just because they're the establishment.
That's right. And she's like, when she gets Pelosi to sort of be like, fine, I'm going to support you.
Uh-huh.
She's not going to fight that. She's not going to be like, fuck you, Pelosi. She's going to be like, all right.
She's going to take it because she's a pragmatist in certain ways. And that's what you need. You need that mix of idealism and pragmatism.
But she also, the way that she's ready to call like Wells Fargo executive out, it's good. It's so good.
Look, I personally have to credit her for being a very important factor in Amazon not fucking destroying my life.
That's right.
Yeah.
That is right. I feel like I continue, because when she was elected, you're like, oh, what is she going to do? When are we going to see her start to sort of make some compromises? And you're like, that's all right. We'll see her make some compromises.
Is she going to be able to sustain this? Yeah.
She has found this site of performance, and I am 100% here for it.
Exactly. One last thought is I was really intrigued and delighted by a tweet she tweeted a couple days ago, where she quote tweeted someone who was citing a study about how informed voters feel about her. It was like, do you feel fully informed enough to make a judgment about AOC? And by a distinct margin, Republicans felt more informed than Democrats about AOC. And also, of course, they had a much more negative idea about her. And she quote tweeted that and was like, oh gosh, it's almost like there's a giant right wing media apparatus with its own whole network practically dedicated to smearing me. And she's fucking right. Like, that's amazing. She has become such a figure, such a figure of importance in their estimation. She's one congressperson from one safe Democratic district in New York City.
Yep.
So there's like two things going on that I think are really interesting. And one of them is the way that they inflate her importance out of fear, and also the way that they inflate her importance out of calculation. Because they need that, because Hillary's going away and they don't have that.
Right. But here's the thing. The way that she's ready for it.
In a way that Hillary wasn't.
Where she's like, you're going to make me this guy. Bring it. Bring it. I'm ready for you. That to me is what's so amazing about it.
That's
like, she knows so I'm here to play this part. Sure. Great.
She's on it. Vox actually had a piece titled AOC Sucks is the New Lock Her Up. The right wing is all in on this stupid bimbo is the future of the Democratic Party and she doesn't know anything. And I just think that's a really losing approach.
Because she has enough experience.
Yeah.
And she's aware enough of what they did to Hillary. She's aware enough. Like, she is so fucking ready for it.
No,
it's
she's
a
ready.
Joy. Yeah.
It's wonderful to behold. I'm just enjoying it.
So we're saying, if anybody has any connections to AOC and we can get her on the podcast.
Oh my God, hook us up. I mean, look. I'm not in her district, but I'm like a mile away from her district. I'm practically her constituent. I know that doesn't count. I can't vote for her.
We are so ready to talk to her about how she's playing these Republicans.
Oh,
she's
God.
So ready for them. It's a joy. It is a joy to watch her negotiate them.
Honestly, if you went to school with her in Westchester,
bring
drop us a DM.
Bring it. So drunk.
I can tell, but like, not like you can tell when I'm drunk. You're holding it together really well.
Well, you usually hold it together very well too. I just feel like that one episode was particularly special.
Like, last week I went out to meet Matt and a friend for like happy hour drinks after work, and I had two cocktails. I came home, I can't remember what I was doing, but I fell on the floor and face planted and bruised my nose. And then was like, I can't get up. I've hurt my nose. And I fell asleep on the floor. Okay. Drunkometer. I want to hear the honest truth.
Oh my God. The honest truth is I'm at a 7 or 8. Like, I'm about to go into my house and be so drunk. I haven't had dinner. I've been like drinking for hours. Like I'm pretty trashed right now.
Good job. Well done.
Thank you. How about you?
I would put myself at a 5, but that's probably an underestimation. Because sometimes it's like after we're finished recording and I go and I stand up and try to walk away, I'm like, oh shit, I'm way drunker than I thought I was.
Right,
but right. Right now I'm feeling 5. I'm like, oh, I feel a little loose. I'm doing all right.
All right. Well, guys, please email us. You've asked us to ruin stuff for you and we have. And we've done such wonderful things for you. So keep emailing us.
I love Maya at a 7. This is great.
Drunk Maya. Oh, yeah. Is yeah.
Kind of sarcastic, but also just being frankly egotistical, Maya.
That's right.
I love it. Yeah. Email us. We are saucepodcast@gmail.com. And also, you can find us on the various social medias, by which I mean Twitter and Instagram. As at Sauce Podcast, we are also on Facebook. We don't check it. So, like, you know, you will see updates there. But if you message us there, you will wait a month until we respond. But eventually we'll get to it.
We will get to it. And if you want to find me directly, you could find me at Maya Garance anywhere you are looking for Maya Garances.
And you can find me as at GynoStar all over the web. Don't tell my students that I tutor. About it.
All right, guys, we have some shows ready for you in the next couple of weeks. We are very excited.
We have topics we're really excited to talk about.
But also, we're so happy when you ask us to ruin things for you because we're really ready to do this. And actually, briefly, somebody asked us to ruin the whole Robert Kraft, like...
Oh, shit.
yeah, I know. I just want you to know, we're listening. We're thinking about it. We're working it out. We want to do it right. Okay?
Yeah. If we do it, we're going to do it right. I mean, that's a topic. That's a fucking
Yeah,
topic.
That's a whole thing. So just All right. Know we have heard you. We see you. We thank you. We're trying to do it right.
All right. Get in touch. Adios, amigos.